heard on great radio stations all across America. It's the National Defense with Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry.
This is the National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry, Communications Director for the VFW, in a special edition of the National Defense today. This is Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army, but as always, the dedication, Jerry.
Hey, this show's for you, the men and women on active duty, serving in the Guard and Reserves, to the millions of veterans out there, all of their families. We love you. God bless you. We're here for you.
And, of course, every Army personnel right now is going, what took you so long? Well, you know, we don't generally specialize in one branch over another.
No.
But hey, listen, our partnership with the Army, it's going to happen once a month. Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army. What a show today. It's like all top stars. We got Brigadier Generals all over the place. General Gary Cheek is going to be with us to talk about Warrior Care Month. And then a call from Iraq, the top medical officer in Iraq, Brigadier General Joseph Caravallo Jr. So that should be fascinating. That's good stuff. And hey, before we get into, we're going to talk a lot about medical and warriors and the care that they get. And I know, Jerry, you got a story about someone from Vietnam.
Yeah. I was surfing the web the other day and I came across a headline and it was Vietnam War hero John Ripley dies at 69. I read that, and I sat back in my chair and felt very sad. John Ripley was a retired Marine colonel. Let me tell you a story, Randy.
Yeah.
I was in Vietnam for a long time, from 69 to 72, and, of course, you hear about Tet of 68.
Yeah.
But in 72, things were standing down in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The, Vietnamization of the war was taking place. And most of the combat troops had gone home. I was reassigned at that time to Military Assistance Command Vietnam, attached to a Vietnamese unit. And there were various teams around the country of advisors. Easter season 1972, the North Vietnamese launched a massive offensive. You don't hear about it, and I've always puzzled about that.
It's pretty late.
Much larger than Tet 68, it was North Vietnamese Army. Not Viet Cong, it was North Vietnamese Army. They had artillery.
Organized.
And they had tanks. So it was a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
And things were pretty hairy. John Ripley, who was a captain at that time, like I said, was on an advisor team, was at the bridge at Dong Ha, which was up by the DMZ. He got orders to hold the bridge at Dong Ha. In fact, the order was hold and die. He and about 600 South Vietnamese were at that bridge, and they were up against 20,000.
Oh my gosh!
NVA and about 200 tanks. Captain Colonel Ripley, crawled under that bridge, under fire, heavy fire. He rigged about 500 pounds of explosives to that bridge and brought it down. I can tell you that if he hadn't have done that, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today talking. A lot of other people wouldn't be around today. For that act, he was awarded the Naval Cross. And I'd like to start a movement, if I could, right here today. I believe deep in my heart that John Ripley more than deserves the Medal of Honor for what he did. And he was a great hero, a tough guy. He made it through four of the toughest military programs in the world, not just in the United States,
yeah,
but the world. He made it through Army Rangers, Marine Recon, Army Airborne.
Wow.
And Britain's Royal Marines.
Oh, my gosh.
He's the only Marine to be inducted into the U.S. Army Ranger Hall of Fame. I spent time with then Captain Ripley on a number of occasions. He was a great guy, a great patriot, and again, what he did at the bridge at Dong Hai, he should be awarded the Medal of Honor.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So, wow. Putting the word out, look up John Ripley, Colonel John Ripley, on the internet. Read about it. Little known about the Easter Offensive in 1972.
Well, how about the orders? Hold and die.
Yeah. The Easter Offensive of 72, as someone who was there, I can tell you, wow. It was not a pleasant thing. It's not easy facing down tanks and artillery.
Wow.
So,
well, you know what? That's a great idea. Look up John Ripley.
Right.
See what you can about him. Honor the man. What a great month to honor heroes.
Yep.
And in the coming days and weeks, we'll be talking more and more about what you can do to do that, and also talking about Veterans Day, of course. So, yeah, John, let's stay on top of that.
Yeah, yeah, it's personal.
And well-deserved.
Yeah.
We're going to start the show. We'll be right back here, that special edition, Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army, right here on the National Defense.
The only truth you'll hear on the radio, the National Defense.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars believes in active allegiance to flag and country. Through legislative activism and service to our military forces, veterans, their families, and communities. Freedom starts at home. Pledge your allegiance again. If you're a veteran and served overseas, you may be eligible to become a member of the nation's elite veterans organization, the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
You've served your country, now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
The following letters were written by our troops.
My dear fellow Americans, I truly appreciate your support. I was starting to wonder if people had forgotten about us over here, but then one of my buddies showed me this website, and now as tears are streaming down my face, I can see for sure that you haven't. Private Emily B., U.S. Army.
It's so heartwarming to see the American people not letting the men and women of the armed forces be forgotten. Your letters make a group of grown men, battle-hardened and gruff, act like a bunch of kids around a Christmas tree. Thanks. Staff Sergeant Matthew H., U.S. Army.
Your support may be the most important thing our troops can carry with them. But don't take our word for it. Take theirs. To show your support, visit americasupportsyou.mil. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to National Defense. It's Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry. And as our part of the Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army, this is so good to do, Jerry.
Absolutely.
Get to know some of these guys and find out who the real heroes are in this deal.
Right. And again, you know, what we do, Randy, is try and bring the truth to the American people,
yep.
Give them some insight into our military, because there's a lot of things going out there. You know, a lot of stories get spread that aren't accurate. At times our military gets painted in a bad light.
Right. Or you just get one side of the story.
Exactly.
And here's the thing that I love too, Jerry. I mean, we've just had an election. We're going to have a new administration. Guess what? With the military, their jobs remain the same.
That's right.
They're doing it today. They go out today like they did yesterday, no matter who's in charge, and they're doing their jobs.
Right. And you know why? For a long time now, Randy, we've talked about care for our warriors.
Right.
And, you know, our good friend General Schumacher's been on the show a number of times.
Yep.
And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a problem at Walter Reed. And quite frankly, in our view, that got blown out of proportion.
Sure.
The military, the Army especially, reacted very well, and they took a lot of steps to make sure that our troops are cared for.
And let me tell you, the guy that we're going to talk to today, we may not be smart enough to have this guy on the phone with us, honestly.
I know.
Brigadier General, Brigadier General Gary Cheek. He currently serves as the Assistant Surgeon General of Warrior Care and Transition, Director of the Warrior Care and Transition Office in the Office of Chief of Staff of the Army. Not one, but two master's degrees.
I'm not talking to him.
General, thank you for being on with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to tell our story to you.
It's great, and you know, that what we were talking about before, in terms of administration, politically, whatever, you get a job to do every day. That doesn't change, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I mean, we're very happy to serve our government and our nation. And whoever the people elect as the commander in chief, that's who we take our orders from, and we're happy to do that.
You know, November is an important month for all of America's veterans, and it should be an important month for every citizen. November 11th, of course, is Veterans Day, but the Army is celebrating Warrior Care Month. General, what is Warrior Care Month?
Yeah, that's a great lead-in for our month, and of course, I agree, November's the perfect month for us to do that. And this is actually sponsored by the Department of Defense under the direction of Secretary Gates. And what he gave us as his guidance was, let's focus on our internal audiences within the Army. So it's not so much an outreach to the public, although we consider all of America part of our audience. But really what we want to do is focus on our soldiers who are wounded, ill, and injured, and make sure that both they and their families are aware of what our program does, some of the changes and initiatives that we have going on, and try to the best of our ability to communicate to them the different services that are available to them so that they can take advantage of them. And of course, in the process of doing that, we hope to reach the larger Army audience, the communities that surround our installations, the political leaders and other influential folks that have been really instrumental in helping us with this program, and then of course the larger American public as well. Because we've done a lot of great things over the past 18 months in this program.
There's a lot of resources available, more so than was available a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
To our wounded. You have the new transition units. We know about those. What other resources are available if a service member is wounded?
Yeah, you know, I think that we had to do a lot of soul searching after the article in the Washington Post about Walter Reed, and when we looked across the Army, we found a number of shortfalls, and so we took immediate action to address that. And I've been in this job for about 6 months, and even when I arrived in this position in May of this year, I was pretty much astounded in what the Army had gotten done. For one thing, we have put our soldiers that are in these units in the best facilities we have on every installation. And so we're making sure that they have facilities that are adequate to their special needs and commensurate with their service and conducive to their healing. The second thing we did is we put together traditional military structure to lead these soldiers, as well as trained medical managers to help them navigate their rehabilitative process. And we matched those together in what we call a triad of care, that around each soldier we have a squad leader, a nurse case manager, and a doctor that oversee and guide that soldier through their rehabilitation. So I think those two resources are really the critical linchpins of putting this together. And now as we look forward over the next year, we're pretty satisfied that we've got it stood up. Now we want to get ourselves focused on increasing our performance, increasing our satisfaction from our soldiers and our cadre and our families. And so we want to make the program better and focus on the future of the soldier, which is outside of those units. So it's a pretty exciting thing to be part of, and it's one that we have an enormous amount of initiative and ideas that we're putting into practice.
As a matter of fact, those warrior transition units, you have so many of them, you're pretty much overwhelmed now, aren't you? There's so many people, and maybe that's not the right word to use, is overwhelmed, but you have so many services available that the response to people coming into these transition units has just been phenomenal, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've had a number of challenges in our program, and you know, I think the foremost thing in this is that, well, for example, right now we have about 11,200 soldiers in our warrior care and transition, or our warrior transition units across the Army. But I can tell you, for every single one of them, they have very unique medical conditions that brought them there, and they bring with them a host of personal either issues or problems, ambitions, dreams. Every one of these soldiers is very individual in their needs, and so we can't use like a cookie-cutter approach to the services. We have to be really adaptive, and I'll just be frank with you, that can be really difficult to meet, you know, their expectations, and sometimes they're not as realistic as they should be. And so that's one of the things we want to focus on, is making our program as predictable as we can so that they know what's coming next, and also help them manage expectations. And our ultimate goal is to get them set up for success, either to continue to serve as a soldier in the Army, or if that's not possible, to be a successful veteran and a viable and productive citizen in their local community.
And you do that, I'm sorry, Randy, and you do that in a number of ways, providing education, retraining, and a number of other things, correct?
Yeah, we require for our soldiers in this program that not only will they get their medical care and work on rehabilitation and therapy, but they also have requirements to go to work or to do get into an education program. And this is where we really want to put a lot of focus and emphasis. And what we don't really want to do is a program with busy work or make work. What I really want to do is, if I can, is develop programs where we can have internships for our soldiers, that while they're recovering, they can do an internship, and then these are for ones that might be leaving the service, with another government agency or other organizations. And for those in the Army, we want to help them understand what they want to do, and if they're changing career paths, we want to get them into a military education program that focuses on that as well. So this is one of the key areas we want to really step out and improve and make, you know, really more challenging and have a better product on the far side.
You're listening to the National Defense. We're talking with Brigadier General Gary Cheek, who's the Assistant Surgeon General of Warrior Care and Transition. And General, you know, you mentioned something early on, and it's something that we keep hearing in every interview that we do on the program, is how you not only serve the military personnel, but also their family. And that's, you know, that's such a change. I loved, we talked to a Marine last week,
right,
that mentioned when he was in Vietnam, that if the Marines wanted you to have a wife, they would issue you one.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah,
the way that has changed, can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, you're a graduate of West Point in 1980, so you've been around this for a long time, about how the families have really factored in big time, you know, through the years.
You know, it is a key part of why we designed the system we have the way we did. This is a much different Army, and I would argue much different military than
right.
It was, say, 30 years ago. When we were a draft-based Army, and, you know, that, I guess it's even more than 30 years ago, 40 years ago, but as a draft Army, we were mostly young, male, and single, but now we're probably about 50% married. As an all-volunteer force, and so it's a much different perspective. And we also, in fighting these two wars, we don't fight these wars with individual replacements, you know, deploying to and returning from theater. We deploy units that go as a unit and return as a unit. And so those dynamics have really changed the way we do this. And in Vietnam, for example, we had Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, as a rehabilitation center for some of our most seriously wounded soldiers. Well, That was closed down in the 1970s, and so as we looked and looked at some alternatives to how we were doing business after the articles about Walter Reed, we did consider recreating these rehabilitation centers, but we decided against that because our soldiers, their families are all over the United States at post camps and stations from where they deployed, as are their comrades in their units. So by putting these warrior transition units at some of our major post camps and stations, we can leverage the medical care that is there. We keep the soldier close to his family and his comrades. When they come back and return, that soldier can keep that close relationship with their unit. So there's a lot of positives to this. And in some cases, for, say, a single soldier, we look for alternatives to get them to a post that maybe the soldier wasn't from but is close to where their home is. So a lot of variables into how we decide where a soldier goes includes the medical condition and personal and unit considerations and those things. But we try to match it as best we can to the unique circumstances of each soldier.
Yeah, and it's a lot different, like you said, from years ago. They're more than just a number. They're people, they're individuals, and the Army is deeply concerned with their care. I think we only have time for about one more question, General. We've got a call coming in from Iraq, but let me preface this question by saying we want to have you back on the show. This is an important topic, and you know, we need to get the word out what the Army's doing. And my question is this: if someone was recently wounded, what's the best advice you'd give to them?
Well, I think the first thing I would give them is some reassurance and tell them the care that is provided by the United States Army is the best in the world, period. Better than any other army, and it is magnificent the way we treat soldiers from the point of injury and the care they receive on the exact location all the way through their evacuation system and their return back to the United States. And, you know, I would also tell them that we will do whatever it takes to restore them to the best condition that we can. So, you know, those are really the key things. We've got a great system here that we can help every one of these soldiers. And I would tell you that assurance that we provide does two great things for us. One, it gives our soldiers the confidence to close with our enemies and fight them with great confidence they'll be cared for. And the other, I think it does, is it gives great confidence to their families that we're going to care for them if they're wounded, ill, or injured. We're going to take care of them and bring them back to the best condition that we can.
That's outstanding. Well, General, thank you so much for being on with us. Yeah, good luck with the month celebration that you're talking about and the awareness that's on the warrior transition situation there. And thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you. It's it's both my honor and my pleasure to both be in the Army, but I really love my job. I mean, what greater honor can I have than to take care of our wounded, ill, and injured soldiers? And it's a great honor that I really cherish every day when I come into work.
Yeah, you're doing a great job.
Absolutely.
And we want to have you back on the show.
I'm ready anytime that you want to bring me on.
If you can pick up one more master's degree in between the time that we talk again, that'd be fantastic.
Okay.
Thanks, General.
Thanks, sir. You know, boy, it must be Brigadier General Week, I guess. That's all we got on the show now. And we got a call. You're right. We do have a call coming in from Iraq. We'll be right back here. It's a special edition of the National Defense, the Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army.
This is the National Defense.
What do you want from the Wizard of Oz?
Just messing with you. But seriously, people don't want to stand in front of my big, awesome wizard head and hear me going, duh. They want answers. That's why I go to USA.gov, the official source for government info. It gives me the smarts to go with the show. Say someone asks for a brain. I go to USA.gov, type in student loans, and 4 years later, they're chock full of knowledge. Is the Wicked Witch terrorizing your neighborhood? Well, move. Then search USA.gov for change of address form so your friends can find you and the witch can't. How about if you're stuck here from Kansas and want to go home? Well, check out USA.gov for the latest travel restrictions and passport applications. I even use it for myself. Bought my sweet ride at a government auction I found on USA.gov. I call it
the Wizmobile.
Balloons are for squares.
For federal and state government information, there's no place like USA.gov.
I know someone with lupus.
My girlfriend.
My mommy.
We work together.
My sister.
My neighbor.
I know someone with lupus.
She's so tired.
Fatigue, achy joints, and fever.
Severe chest pains, heart problems.
Her kidneys gave up.
He had a seizure.
pain never stops.
Someone you know.
Someone you know.
Someone you know.
Someone you know has lupus.
But there is hope. For information, contact the Lupus Foundation of America at 888-38-LUPUS or lupus.org.
The following letter was written by Sergeant Leroy P., U.S. Army.
I'm currently on my third tour to Iraq. Never have I ever seen so much love and support from people I don't even know. My mom always told me that there are angels among us. And right now, I really do believe that. Very much.
Your support may be the most important thing our troops can carry with them. To show your support, visit americasupportsyou.mil. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to National Defense. It's Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry. And it is a not only a special week, we're dedicating this week, of course, to the Army. It's Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army. And it's also, I had no idea, Brigadier General Week. Because
that's who, it is, yeah.
Just had on the show. Brigadier General Joseph Caravallo, he's calling in from Iraq. He's the top medical officer in Iraq. What an honor. General, thank you for being on with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure and privilege to be with you. And a special hello to all your listeners.
General, the top medical guy in Iraq, give us an idea what that means. What falls under your umbrella of command?
Well, I'm dual-hatted, actually. I work for both Multinational Force Iraq and Multinational Corps Iraq. So on the former, I am the advisor then on medical issues to General Odierno and for strategic level medical issues. And then at the operational level, I work for General Lloyd Austin at MNCI, or Multinational Corps Iraq. And under that umbrella, I'm responsible for all aspects of healthcare, and that ranges from care for the troopers, all aspects of healthcare, prevention and diagnosis and treatment and evacuation. And then under the strategic umbrella, I'm the person that interfaces with the Ministry of Health and Iraqi healthcare, and doing our part from the medical standpoint in improving the respect and confidence for the Ministry of Health in moving the government of Iraq towards self-reliance. And then we're also responsible for oversight for detainee healthcare operations. So really, anything that has the word health in it, I have responsibility
wow.
for.
Wow, that's a big responsibility.
That is.
General, on a strategic level, what kind of situation is it for the Iraqi government? What happened? We all know there was a problem with infrastructure, which our militaries worked very hard to rebuild, working with Iraqi civilians in the government. Medically speaking, what was the situation like in Iraq? The medical care system cease to exist?
Well, you know, what's fortunate for Iraq is they started as regional healthcare leaders. And in the 70s, people would come here for transplant surgery, for heart surgery, for all big consultations. So the folks that are my age, in their 50s and so, remember the good time when they were regional healthcare leaders. And then when the regime of Saddam Hussein came on board and he directed 90% of his GDP to the military, there's a stagnation over the next 20 to 30 years in healthcare, and where they started off with about 80 to 100,000 physicians as a surrogate marker for healthcare, they dropped down to about 34,000 physicians by 2003. And so this is through the Iran-Iraq War, through the Persian Gulf War, through the UN sanction period. And then in 2003, the start of OIF, there was a large exodus of technocrats and the intellectuals and the health professionals and what have you. And they went from 34,000 to 17,000, with another 2,000 or so who were killed or kidnapped. So their health care was stagnated for 20 to 30 years, and then it really took a major drop. So to answer your question, it was they were in dire straits with regards to just the healthcare infrastructure in general. This is a significant focus for us during a counterinsurgency to help the people, help the Iraqi system to regain that level of leadership in the region with regards to healthcare.
Yeah, we're talking with General, who is the top medical officer in Iraq, Joseph Caravallo. And General, I wanted to ask you about this question and your participation with the Ministry of Health. This is a great story, and I want to just kind of tell this story about this little girl, Shireen. It was a two-year-old girl who sustained a severe kerosene fire burn to over 50% of her body. She was treated and stabilized by Iraqi doctors but needed further surgery to help her survive. Her family could not afford the specialized care, so she came to Baghdad for assistance. The National Iraqi Assistance Center coordinated the necessary sponsors to get Shireen the care she needed. Iraqi doctors reviewed, prepared the records. Hospital in the United States provided free, specialized care, and an American sponsor provided the necessary funding, and she's progressing well in her treatment. I mean, General, this has got to just be so gratifying for you to have this kind of partnership in place and give some hope to the Iraqi people. That's just amazing.
Yeah, those are all great humanitarian assistance types of stories, and even though we wear a uniform, whether it's Army, Navy, or Air Force, we are coded to take care of all humans. So it really pulls at our heartstrings when we have the ability to help someone in that setting.
Well, you never hear that story over here.
Oh boy, that's too bad. But I have to tell you that again, the Iraqi healthcare system is pretty good, and they're getting better. So the ultimate goal is for Iraq to regain that stature where the best good news story is when they can do it on their own, and they don't need to go to the United States, and we can partner here to do that. But until then, when the situations arise, we're very, very happy to help out in those types of situations to help out young patients in need.
I have a question, and it's along the lines of cultural differences. Any obstacles in that respect, treating females or on a different level, trying to bring Iraqi females into the system for medical training?
No, there's a fair number of female doctors. I've not noticed a difference in that regard. Where there is a difference relative to healthcare in the United States is culturally. It strikes me that there are not nursing care at the same level that we see in the United States, and there are not enough women interested in nursing here. And part of that is the there's been a stigma, and that's probably been the last 20 years or so, that have pulled women away from the healthcare field. And what we're trying to do is, in concert with the Iraqi leadership, is to bring back the idea that it's noble to be in healthcare, it's noble to be a nurse, and to provide care in augmentation to the physician, to provide a full healthcare team. That's probably the only difference that I've seen with regards to women in healthcare.
What do you think some of the biggest challenges you have trying to make this transition? I know we've come a long way, a lot of success stories, but there still has to be some stumbling blocks there.
Right. Well, we see healthcare as an essential service, and you know this is a multifaceted jewel, of which you know I get to just look at one facet in healthcare, and so we're doing everything we can to have the people of Iraq regain confidence in that system. And if you know, again from my perch, if there's ever a tipping point, it's when there's popular support, a recognition of a right to good healthcare. And once you have that, I think people have a hard time turning away from that. and then recognizing the insurgents as people who want chaos more than being an ideologue. So that's where I think it's a good focus for us to really prop up the healthcare system. And I think you're asking for what's the bridging strategy for the military. And for us, it's relatively easy with regards to utilizing NGOs and IGOs who also do this level of healthcare to then partner with the Iraqi medical leadership and continue to move them forward to regain stature. And there's some work that we're doing both with NGOs and with some American universities that have interest in helping out. So it's very, very encouraging.
Great. Now, we've talked about some of the problems, difficulties within the Iraq. Let's talk for a brief moment about medical care for our service members. I know that the United States has great, quick means and ways of treating our wounded, our injured, and our ill. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I'll tell you, I really feel like I'm living the dream because I just spent a little bit of time telling you about what I do at the strategic level, but then I get to turn around and do it again at the operational level. So I do get to think about specifically about care for our warriors. And we medics, corpsmen, and healthcare professionals are committed to providing the very best care for all of our warriors and through the whole spectrum of healthcare. And a lot of what we've done it stems right from the planning stage where I have a very good sense of where every American is in this country or every group of Americans. And then we consider, should that American get hurt, can he or she get to a surgeon in a timely fashion? And then if they're too far from our fixed hospitals, we will plant a surgical team in the right at the right point so that when we move them, they get to the right place. And the key is whether they can get to a surgeon. And then you take that and all the things we've learned over the years to help improve our capabilities of getting someone who's injured. Now, I'm just talking about traumatic injury because we have the whole spectrum of care that we can provide. But if you take all the trauma, we are throwing everything at this to make sure that everyone gets back home. So to the point where we train all our soldiers in combat life saving, we give them all an individual first aid kit, which has a tourniquet, which may be the biggest thing we've done in this war to save lives. The fact that we keep improving the personal protective equipment or the individual body armor so that protects the torsos of these individuals. So now we're left with potential limb injuries, which can still be devastating. The tourniquets really help with that. Eye guards that protect their eyes, and should they injure their eyes, the fact that we know how to protect their eyes in transit. And this may be interesting for your listeners, is one of the biggest things we've done is use blankets. We have found by research that one of the biggest causes of bad outcomes is for a patient to become hypothermic or for their blood temperatures to go down. So we make a big effort to make sure that they're warm. And you would think in 140-degree weather, that shouldn't be an issue.
Right.
But when you get
right.
in a helicopter and you're traveling at 120 knots, it can get very cold. So we make a big effort of tracking that. And then some of the things – I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And then we are able to move these patients to the surgeon. And then in surgery, the things that we've done, we are changing the way trauma surgery is managed across the country. It's so very exciting. And it's done based on good scientific research, so it's not anecdotal, and that it can be carried on, generalized. And we're actually, as I said before, changing some processes. And in particular, we're doing what's called damage control surgery, which is you don't do the complete surgery that's needed at the first time they see the surgeon, but you just stabilize the soldier or warrior. And when the person has a massive transfusion requirement, you start giving them what's called fresh blood. So in the States, blood is considered good up to 42 days. But we're doing it. We're giving blood that's at the 7 day. We're shipping it from the States and getting here within 7 days. And if necessary, we're giving it to them under 7 to 10 days from drawing the blood. We're using plasma to augment at the right ratios that gives us good results. We're using factor 7, which is normally was initially used for hemophiliacs. We're finding that helps with our patients who have massive transfusion requirements. And then if needed, we are ginning up aircraft just for a single warrior who's wounded if the need arises. And we can get those types of soldiers back to Walter Reed or Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio within 30 hours of getting to the first surgeon in Iraq. So we're pulling out the stops. This follows our warrior ethos of never leaving a fallen comrade and placing mission first. And I can't be more proud of our troopers, our healthcare providers, in doing everything we can to help every soldier get back to the United States and get the maximum benefit of care, all the way back to what General Cheek was talking about.
Wow. You're listening to Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army. It's a special edition of the National Defense, and we're talking to Brigadier General Joseph Caravallo, the top medical officer in Iraq. And, General, when you're talking about training some of the men in the field, that's so important and one of the revolutionary new ideas that has come about here in the past few years. And we've talked to a couple of folks. In fact, we talked to a guy on the ground a couple of weeks ago that had used the tourniquet to save the life, I think, of an Iraqi patrol personnel. And that was the training that he had received just since he enlisted. So you can see how important those efforts are. And, you know, it's so funny when we talk to you and you hear the passion in your voice when you're talking about these things. I'm thinking at the same time, here's a guy that could be back in the States earning a top living as a physician, and you're giving your service to the country. And I just thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for saying, but it's every one of us. We have, I'll tell you, just from the medical corps side of the house, we have folks who are Tufts graduates, Stanford graduates, Duke graduates. We could all do, make more money on the outside, but it's when you get right down to it, it's not about the salary.
Right.
When you're out there taking care of patients in the civilian world, it's one patient at a time. And for us here, I'll tell you, we feel like we can take care of thousands of people at a time. Wow. At my level, it's a policy and oversight and things like that. But every surgeon, every doc feels like they're helping out somebody's brother, somebody's sister, mother, cousin, and I'll tell you, that is very, very rewarding. And the only reason we medics get to be in the Army or the Air Force or the Navy is for those warfighters. So we know those are the true heroes who are putting their lives on the line every day, and just so that we can be part of that is, I'll tell you, that is very gratifying. Now, that being said, I'm very, very happy that my wife and family are supportive. So I can't, if it weren't for our families being supportive, it'd be very hard to do this. So it really is a team effort all the way around.
Yeah, and on a personal level, General, for those of us, especially who've served in the infantry, the medics who have, what can you say about a medic? My own experience in Vietnam and when I was in Afghanistan, we had a medic, as a matter of fact, whose name is on the headquarters of the Warrior Transition Unit, Doc Vaccaro, Angelo Vaccaro. My last trip to Afghanistan, spent some time with the cache at FOB Salerno. Rode with the medevac teams, and the intensity and the dedication, and when someone came into that cache who was hurt, it wasn't just the doctors and nurses who were on duty; it was everyone who was assigned to that cache, from the commander, who was not a physician, but he would be out at that helipad helping bring that wounded person into that cache. And, All we can say to you and all those medical personnel is thank you so much for your dedication and God and your commitment.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for saying that. You know, we share a very special relationship with the infantrymen in the Army, and we recognize that. And if we can't be in the infantry, then thank goodness we're in the medical field. And we get to mix it up with the infantrymen. We send some of our best troopers out there in harm's way with you all. And if we can't be there, we're there to receive you or fly you or operate on you. And it's any warrior that is injured. We want to make sure they get home to their families. We know that the courageous sacrifices they're making, and we feel our part is small part, but it is very rewarding. And I have to tell you that we have a bunch of medics who are taking care of detainees as well. And that's maybe a little tougher job, but you come out here, it's easy to take care of somebody's sister, brother, that type of thing. But
right.
When you are taking care of a detainee, someone's trying to hurt one of your sisters or brothers, that takes a lot of effort. But these people recognize that they're doing strategic level work, because every one of those detainees, or most of them, are going to go back home. And when they go back home, they're going to send a message that, hey, America is all right.
Right.
They took care of me. I tried to hurt them, but they took care of me. And if that turns things around, that's a great strategic win for us.
Hey, you know, I would at least like to know that the detainees get smaller tourniquets than our guys do.
You know, the beauty is it's encoded in us. You know, once you're not a combatant, you're human. And
right.
So everyone's the same. And I am very encouraged that I've never, ever heard of anything other than treating it that way. And that's what America expects of us, and we're holding and standing tall, performing that mission.
Right, and I'll stand witness to what you were saying, and I apologize for overlooking that when I made my statement about being at the cache at Salerno, because I saw those medevac crews transport the bad guys, and I saw the medical personnel turn out in equal numbers. When it was a detainee or a civilian, there was no difference.
Yes.
Well, and you know that it goes back to like the battle of the minds too. You know, because you have to win that mind war as well. And when
right.
when you're fighting a different culture like that, and you're showing them that there is another way, boy, that's just so important.
Right.
Well, General, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for your service, and boy, we'd love to have you back on sometime.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on. And you all have a great day. And again, a special shout out to all your listeners. Appreciate all your support for all of us out here in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Brigadier General Joseph Caravallo Jr. from Iraq, the top medical officer in Iraq. Can you even imagine? I mean,
awesome responsibility,
some
man.
Big shoulders.
Big
there.
Responsibility.
Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army. It's a special edition of the National Defense. We'll be right back.
We're standing guard with the truth, the national defense.
The VFW is looking for a few more heroes. The largest combat veterans organization in America wants to get you involved and keep you active. With nearly 2 million members and 9,000 posts around the country, the VFW is doing the tough job of supporting our troops. You can be a part of all the excellent programs to keep the fires burning on the front lines. Programs such as Operation Uplink, with phone cards for active duty and hospitalized veterans, Adopt a Unit, which provides assistance for nearly 1,000 military units, and care package efforts for the troops serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Only someone who's been there can understand what it means to be remembered. The VFW has been the heart and soul of the military for over 100 years. Isn't it time you stake your claim as a veteran? Call the VFW Membership Department at 1-888-JOIN-VFW or log on to VFW.org for more details. You've served your country. Now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
In a military warehouse south of Washington, D.C., a USO stuffing party is in full swing. By the end of the day, volunteers will have stuffed over 10,000 USO care packages, packed them in boxes, loaded them on trucks, and sent them on their way to our soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and military bases around the world. They'll stuff them full of things that most of us take for granted, but that our troops don't often have. Things like toiletries, playing cards, candy, books, little things. Little things that carry an enormous message to our troops. Little things like thank you, like we'll never forget you, like we're behind you 100%, like we love and cherish each and every one of you. Little things. We're all about the little things. We're the USO. So are you. For more information and to find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO. Until everyone comes home.
Welcome back to National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry. We don't have time to fit any more Brigadier Generals in today.
No.
That's about it. Hey, you know what, though? New administration, same show. The truth. You're going to have it here always. A special edition this week, Voices of Strength, an hour with America's Army. Thank you so much to the Brigadier General Gary Cheek and also to Joseph Caravallo, the top medical officer in Iraq. Huge program.
Yep, great show.
And
as always,
we'll be right back. And hey, and by the way, if you want to send us a message, get it to us, thenationaldefense@vfw.org. Your suggestions, your comments, your questions, whatever you got, you can get it to us there, thenationaldefense@vfw.org. Oh, and we got a quick shout out, Jerry.
Knucklehead Radio.
Absolutely. They're doing their selection for the American Patriot on Veterans Day. If you go to knuckleheadradio.com, you can get in on that. And those guys are great over there.
They are.
Thank you so much. Hey, listen, we will be back next week right here on the National Defense. Thanks for listening.
I never thought that this is where I'd settle down. I thought I'd die an old man back in my hometown. They gave me this plot of land, me and some other men. For a job well done. There's a big white house, sits on a hill just up the road. The man inside, he cried the day they brought me home. They folded up a flag and told my mom and dad, we're proud of your son. And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace. I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington. I remember Daddy brought me here when I was 8. We searched all day to find out where my granddad lay. And when we finally found that cross, he said, son, this is what it cost to keep us free. Now here I am, 1,000 stones away from him. Recognized me on the first day I came in, and it gave me a chill when he clicked his heels and saluted me. And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best of company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for